Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. Before the episode, I just wanted to add a few comments. Being that this will be the 100th episode of the Sfarim Chatter podcast, so I felt it would be appropriate to come on here and first of all say thank you to all the listeners for all the support and feedback that I've gotten on the podcast throughout the, I guess, year and a half or so that it is. All the comments and questions and constructive criticism and various feedback that I've gotten via email, Twitter, direct message on Twitter, and otherwise. Obviously, also want to point out everyone should feel free to email me, sfarimchatter@gmail.com, if you have any questions or comments or guest suggestions. Appreciate that. I guess it's worth pointing out that the podcast now is 100 episodes, well over 100,000 total downloads, which honestly is, you know, much beyond what I thought. Of course, when you start something, you hope it'll be successful. You think maybe it'll be. I had the Twitter account already, but, you know, Baruch Hashem, it's really been a lot more than I thought, averaging well over 1,000 listens an episode. And, you know, these numbers include also the original shows, which were done on Periscope Twitter. If any of the listeners remember those, they were listening when they used to be live, with, yeah, comments. So a lot of people listen there, and now those are the original, I don't know, 20 or so episodes. I don't remember the exact number that were on, that's on the podcast. Forthcoming episodes, I guess I'll mention a couple of things. You know, I never don't usually say what's forthcoming, maybe on Twitter sometimes, my WhatsApp status, but I do have a couple of, I have a lot of episodes recorded already, and I have a lot of guests, you know, Mirza Shem, that I will be recording with. But just to mention a few, Professor Jeffrey Wolf on the Marik, Professor Francesca Trivolato on the Jews of Livorno, Professor Rina Lauer on the Jews of Crete, Rav Daniel Neustadt on the writings that he edited and published of Yaakov Kamenetsky, and also his own halacha writings, Rav Gabriel Becha from the Forged Yerushalmi Kachim, and there's probably another 10 plus episodes that I already have recorded. So those to mention a few. Also, I mentioned before the Rosh Hashanah episode, the one that went up before Rosh Hashanah, that also, I'm working on a series on Shabbos Tzvi, on Sabbateanism. I would say that I am still working on that. I don't know when it'll come out. It's going to be a 10-part series, Mirza Shem. I'll already mention the ones that I've recorded. There's two episodes recorded, Professor Matt Goldish, Professor Jakob Dweck. I already recorded an episode with him about Rabbi Jakob Sasportis, Professor Pavel Macheko on the Franks and Jacob Frank. So, you know, and there's a couple more planned. The Mirza Shem, they're going to get done. I haven't done them yet, so I don't want to say, but it should be a really good series, I think. And so that I wanted to mention that. That's what's coming up. If anybody wants to sponsor an episode or to support the show, so first of all, I want to thank all those that have already sponsored episodes and supported the show. You know, very much appreciate it. And if anybody would like to, they can email me, sfarimchatter@gmail.com. Like I said, I mentioned some that I have. And then there's, like I said, there's many more that I have recorded that I didn't mention. And then there's other ones that I already have agreed with and, you know, just have to get down to doing them. And also, you know, guest suggestions. I always appreciate having, you know, ideas. You know, there are some all the time that get brought up to me. And I very much appreciate that. Just finally, you know, thank you to everyone for subscribing. If you didn't subscribe, please subscribe wherever you listen. It helps the podcast. And also, if you use Apple, rating and reviewing on Apple is helpful as well. So thank you. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Mati Ben-Melech, who is a college lecturer in Jewish history at Herzog College, and who is the author of the book in Hebrew, Shlomo Molcho, Chayav Umoto Shel Mashiach Ben Yosef, from Machon Yad Yitzchak Ben Tzvi. And we'll be discussing Shlomo Molcho. So thank you very much, Dr. Ben-Melech, for joining me.
Thank you.
So first, let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I attended Yeshivat Har Etzion in Alon Shvut, also known as the Gush. And after spending the 6 years in Yeshiva, I went to university to study history. I studied history in the Hebrew Jewish history. And this book is actually my dissertation. My dissertation about Shlomo Molcho, which was wrote under the supervision of Professor Reuven Bonfield from the Hebrew University.
So how did you get into Shlomo Molcho? I mean, I guess we should start off, tell the listeners who Shlomo Molcho was. I mean, I know a lot of people may not. I was telling you before, I posed this to a bunch of people, and they didn't really know who Shlomo Molcho was. So who was he? When did he live? And obviously, we'll get into the details of his fascinating life later throughout the episode, but who was Molcho? And then, you know, how did you get into such a topic?
Molcho was the son of Anusim parents. I don't know what the right phrase to use in this platform, but I guess Anusim is a good enough word. His parents were Anusim from Portugal. They were forced to convert with the whole Portuguese Jew, with all of the Portuguese Jews in 1497. He was born in 1501, and at the age of 25, after meeting a very interesting person about which I will talk later, he came back to Judaism. He circumcised himself. He had to leave. Naturally, he had to leave Portugal. He moved to Italy, and he gained reputation as a darshan. Sermons were attended by his drashot, were attended by many people, Jews and non-Jews alike. And he was also a sort of a visionary. I mean, he saw visions, he dreamt dreams, and he became a messianic harbinger. And he was claiming that the Messiah should arrive in the year 1540. And he had followers, he had those who were trying to stop him, we had adversaries. And eventually, in 1532, when he was 31 years old, he went to meet the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. And the meeting, which was to be the highest point of his messianic career, didn't develop as expected. And he was arrested and later executed by the Emperor Al-Kiddush Hashem. Another point that should be mentioned at this stage already is that some very serious Jewish scholars, such as Rabbi Shlomo El-Kabatz, the author of Lecha Dodi, or Rabbi Yosef Karo, admired him and expressed high regards and high appreciation for him. So he was not this sort of a messianic lunatic or something like that. He was praised and was taken very seriously by some of the most important scholars of this Jewish scholars of this period.
Now, sorry, we'll get more into this. So how did you get into this subject? I mean, how did this decide to work on this?
Actually, by accident. I just finished my master's degree, and in my master's degree I was working on a book, and my advisor back then told me that this is the perfect solution for the perfect subject for a master's degree or even a PhD, to take a book and to write something about this book. He told me that way you will absolutely find something about it. There won't be any problem. The point was that after working for a year and a half on this book, it was clear to me that I don't want to work on books anymore. And I wanted something more, more alive. And when I was talking to my tutor back then, to Professor Bonfield, who was close to his pension, he told me, look, there are many subjects that I was planning to write about, and I'm too old for that. So Listen to my suggestions. And the second one was Shlomo Molcho. And I didn't know anything about it when it started. I mean, I had this vague, very vague knowledge. I heard the name. And he offered me to write a biography, which turned into this biography of Mashiach ben Yosef.
And we'll get Yeah, and hopefully we'll get more into that, and people will be able to know more. So someone you alluded to there in the opener, we're going to go about Molcho. We're going to start mainly not about Molcho, because there's another very, very important figure, and that's as early on in your book, which is David Haruveni, who shows up in Venice in the early 16th century, and he claims that he is a brother, an emissary of the Yosef, the king of Reuven, and God and Chatzi Yosef Menashe, the Jewish kingdom somewhere. And just a fantasy, he was dressed up. We'll talk about how he was, just who was this figure? What is going on here with him?
Okay, so this is a real mystery. Who was David Reuveni? And if you look into scholarly literature about David Reuveni, you find that some very serious scholars claim that he was an Ashkenazi Jew, that he was a Sephardi Jew, that he was the Yemenite, that he was an Indian Jew from India, or that he was a Jew from Ethiopia. So basically, there's not a single, and of course from Yemen. So I think that there isn't a single Eda, single tribe in the Jewish world that it was not claimed that Reuveni came from. And the point is that this is really mysterious. The story, I mean, this guy arrives and he claims this fantastic claim that, you know, he's from the lost tribes of Israel, his brother is the king of the lost tribes, and he's actually an ambassador of the lost tribes of Israel. But the interesting thing is that he arrives in the right time. He arrives in the best time ever in history to introduce yourself as someone from a lost nation, as someone from a lost tribe, because early 16th century is the period, is what is known as the period of geographical discoveries. Many lands were discovered back then. Travelers came back from places with stories about fantastic things that they saw. And this is exactly the best time in the world to come and say, okay, you discovered America, you discovered all those places in Africa, in the East. Here I am, a member of the Lost Tribes of Israel. And indeed, this was also a period in which Jews and non-Jews alike were searching for the Lost Tribes of Israel. And therefore, when a man comes claiming that he is a representative of the Lost Tribes of Israel, people took him really seriously, including the Pope. The interesting thing about him is that when he arrived in Venice, his first interaction with the Jews was that he was begging for money. And he gave them this whole story about how he lost all his money in the way and so forth. But, you know, the Venetian Jews, they were all rich merchants. It seemed weird to them that an ambassador from free Jewish state would arrive without the money, without, you know, all those servants that he's supposed to have. But eventually they decided to help him in a way. They gave him some money and he made his way to Rome, where he met the Pope, and he introduced himself as a messenger from the Lost Tribes. The Pope didn't know what to do with him, with that kind of thing. I mean, because he might be a charlatan, he might be a lunatic, but it also might be serious. You know, only a few years ago, the Pope met, or other people in Europe met, people who came from across the sea, heard about kingdoms in America, in Africa. So it does make sense. This might be right. And it ended up with the Pope writing him letters of recommendations to the King of Portugal. And he writes to the King of Portugal. I know that you have to remember that in early 16th century, Portugal is the greatest naval force in Europe. Portuguese sailors arrived to India. They controlled the whole spice trade with India. Portugal is extremely rich. And the Pope writes to the Portuguese king and tell him, look, there is this guy who claims that he's coming from a free Jewish state in the East. I can judge it. I assume that you can know better than me if he is from there or not. And if he is indeed from that country, okay, so see what he wants. And if you can cooperate with him, cooperate. And with this letter, David Reuveni arrives in Portugal. And in Portugal, we have all the letters. We have copies of all the writings between him and the royal court. And the king invites him to visit him at the royal court, which is it was not in Lisbon at that time. It was in a small city not far away from Lisbon called Almerim. Now, when the king preferred to be in the country rather than in the big city because of the plague. This is a period in which every few years the plaque starts again, and the best place to be is in the countryside. So the king is there in Almerin. It's a small town near the sea. And when the king court travels, the Supreme Court travels with him. Because the Supreme Court is always with the king. It had to deal with various constitutional things, whatever. And one of the judges in this court is a guy named Diogo Pires, who is actually a son of a converted parent. And he is very young at this, he's 24 years old, but he's a bright young guy, and there is a great future to him in Portugal. And when Reuveni arrives at the royal court, he meets there this young guy, this Diogo Pires. And a short time after Reuveni arrived there, Diogo Pires begins to see all kinds of visions, and at night, mystical dreams, things like that. And he doesn't understand what's going on, but he does understand that it has to do something with this Jew who arrived from the land of the lost tribes. And he goes to him, and another thing that Molcho realizes through these visions that he has is that in order to understand those visions, he has to circumcise himself. And he goes to Reuveni and tells him, okay, you are a Jew, so please help me to circumcise myself. Or please circumcise me. And the point is that this is exactly what Reuveni didn't want to do, because by doing this, he will break his ties to the Portuguese court. But and I don't get into the question of what those ties were, what was his purpose. And when he refuses, what Molcho does is he circumcises himself, and indeed after he almost dies in the process, after he comes back to his strength, he sees a vision in which, as I interpreted it, he gets the job of Mashiach ben Yosef. And basically, from here on, he has a mission. And his mission is to do the job of, and again, I don't get into the question, what does Mashiach ben Yosef, what is the mission of Mashiach ben Yosef, but he sees himself as Mashiach ben Yosef. So this meeting between Reuveni and Molcho was a critical point for both of them. It was a critical point for Molcho because he began seeing his visions back then, because he circumcised himself after seeing the... after meeting Reuveni, but it was also very dramatic for Reuveni, because when the king realizes what happened to his young and promising, to this young and promising a judge in the high court, he throws Reuveni away, and Reuveni fails. He doesn't succeed in his mission in Portugal. He has to leave Portugal because the king tells him, you have bad influence on the Anusim, on the new Christians.
Now, something of Reuveni that we have is his diary, and that's been published a new edition some time ago, a while back. But is that what you something you discussed it at length in your book? Is the diary trustworthy? Is that a good source? Was that Reuveni, you know, edited it how he wanted us to see it? What's the story with the diary?
The diary also has an interesting story. It was discovered in the 19th century. There is no reference to the diary before that, although we do know that it existed. We do know that it existed, and that we also know that it existed in Spain. But in the 19th century, a single copy of the diary was discovered in the hands of a German Jewish book collector, and later on, it was bought by I think the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and they made a copy of it. And later on, it was sent to Breslau, to the Jewish seminary in Breslau, as a loan. And back then, you didn't have all those digital versions that you could send. So they sent them the original, and it was lost there. So basically, the diary is lost. the only thing that we have is this copy that was prepared in Oxford, and therefore we can't examine the paper, we can't examine the handwriting and try and tell when this was written. Is this a Western script or an Eastern? Is the handwriting Western, Eastern, whatever? We don't know anything. We only have the content of the diary. And the diary is certainly a problematic thing. It is in many cases. I'll say it that way. Many details in the diary can be proved from other sources, but on the other hand, many little details in the diary can't be proved at all. And my feeling is that the big picture is indeed realistic. I mean, he traveled those places, he talked with these people, but the little details are very problematic. So we can't trust the diary when he's saying that he was meeting the Pope, that he was traveling to Portugal, that the Pope gave him letters of recommendation, that he got these letters from the King of Portugal, etc. But when he's telling us about all kind of fantastic things that happened in the way from his kingdom to Egypt and to the land of Israel, when he tells us about all kind of things that he did in the land of Israel, in Har HaBayit or in other places, in that case, we have to take a lot of salt and pepper, I'll say. We can't take it it is not trustworthy. He had his purpose in writing this diary, and we have to consider it. But again, regarding his encounter with Molcho, basically his description of this encounter is pretty similar to Molcho's description of the encounter, and therefore there is no reason to not to believe to what they both write about it.
Okay, and I'm sure we'll return to Ruveni throughout the rest of the episode. And there's more, like you said, about the diary and others, that there's a chapter in your book dedicated to this. People can read more in there. So returning to Molcho, we mentioned that he was a judge and he was young. He circumcised himself, but I don't know if perhaps you want to talk a little bit more about him and his youth and his upbringing, and you know, until the stage to Ruveni comes, and then what happens after that, where he ends up afterwards.
Yeah. So basically, we don't know anything about this. The first time we meet Molcho is 24 years old, and he is in the royal court as a member of this Supreme Court. Now, in Portuguese documents that refer to him, he's always referred to as a doctor. So, which means that he had some sort of university education. There was only one university in the 16th century in Portugal. This is the Coimbra University. And when I was checking in the archive of the university, I couldn't find his name. But on the other hand, the archive was established something like in 1537, while Molcho graduated in the early 1520s. So it doesn't mean that he didn't went there. But again, we don't know anything about him at that period. We don't know who his parents were. We don't know where he comes from. There is only one very short reference to his parents in his writing. His writing, Ki Aviv Imia Zavuni, which is surprising, because it seems that he left his parents and not his parents left him. So it's a mystery. I mean, I don't know. You can speculate, you can suggest all kinds of things, but what we really don't know anything about it. The interesting thing is that an Anus, a son of Anusim, becomes a judge in the Supreme Court at his very early 20s. So regarding this point, he was certainly very, very talented young man. And one also has to understand the inner politics of Portugal back then. The king was trying to establish a new system of courts in order to strengthen himself and make the nobles, the lords and the dukes of Portugal take some of their power off. And for that reason, he established a system of courts which was based not on hereditary, I mean, not on having some sort of a noble title, but on practices and on education. And therefore, Molko for him was probably the best candidate to hold a position in this system because he's not connected to the nobility at all. As a son of new Christians, he doesn't have any support, any outer support other than the king. So if he will appoint him to this position, he will owe the king the position, and you have to assume that he will be a very loyal judge in this system. And indeed, Molko, we have his letter of appointment to this position. He was very young. He was already appointed. He was probably highly admired by the king, and I assume that it was because of his extraordinary talents and abilities.
Right, and then obviously the part we mentioned earlier, Ruveni shows up, Molko circumcises himself, gives him bris milah, and he leaves Portugal. So I guess let's pick up at that point if you have anything more to say on that. And then where he heads from there is an issue, a question. That's something that you discuss in your book. You arrive at a little bit of a different conclusion than others have, and explain that and why you arrived there.
Okay. So first, the first point that we have to remember is that, and this is again, this is surprising. This is part of the story of Molko being a great mystery, and that is that he had by then, although he didn't circumcise himself until he met Reuven, he already had a pretty good Jewish education, and he was speaking Hebrew, he was reading Hebrew, he knew all the basic writings of I won't say that he was ordained or something like that, but he had a deep knowledge of halacha and the modern net of Kabbalah, and we know that because only 2 years later, he already prepared a book of messianic Kabbalistic sermons. He has this book ready for publishing, to be published. And this is not the kind of knowledge that you can gain in a year or year and a half or 2 years that spent since he left Portugal and until this book was ready. It is clear that he gained this education in Portugal. Now, I'll say few words about Portugal. Back then, the Jews of Portugal were forced to convert themselves in 1497. And basically, unlike the Jews of Spain, which were expelled, and big amounts of Jews from Spain, tens of thousands of Spanish Jews, when they were expelled from Spain, they turned to Portugal. So we see that the Portuguese Jewry at the beginning of at late 15th century is a Judaism in which the Portuguese Jews, a big amount of them are Jews who were in Spain, who could have converted and stayed in Spain, but preferred to stay loyal to their beliefs and to their religion and move to Portugal. And now, 5 years later, they are being forced to convert themselves in Portugal. And then in Portugal, they don't have the chance. They don't have the ability to say, okay, we will leave Portugal. They are not allowed to leave the country. They are forced to convert themselves. So there is no doubt that many of those Jews were learned people. Many of the Jews were highly graded scholars, and they were forced to convert themselves now. But they still obtain both the belief and the knowledge with them. Now, in the first years after the forced conversion in Portugal, the Portuguese king ordered that nobody should look into the way that those new Christians, those conversos, those anusim live. And basically what he did was letting them on the outside. Of course, they had to behave as Christian, but no one was checking what they were doing in their inner rooms, in their basements, etc. So it seems that it was possible to gain Jewish education, not in a formal way, but in an informal way, in some hidden places, it was definitely possible to get a Jewish education in Portugal, and Molcho probably got this education there. The interesting point is that although he is well aware of Judaism, of Jewish law, of Jewish Kabbalah, he doesn't circumcise himself until the arrival of Reuveni. So basically, I would say that Molcho was sort of poseach al shnei ha-seifim, not deciding where he is. Is he a Jew? Is he a Christian? Is this something in between? And the arrival of Reuveni helped him or forced him to choose side. Am I a Jew or am I a Christian? And he was choosing the Jewish side. Now, of course, after he circumcised himself and after this was made known, he couldn't stay in Portugal because he would be burnt on the stake. So he left Portugal. And the question is, where did he go?
So I want to just jump in before we get to when he left. First of all, about Molcho growing up with a Jewish education, we should mention that there was no Inquisition in Portugal at this time. So in Spain there was, but in Portugal there wasn't. So that's important.
That's a good point. Yeah, the Inquisition was established in Portugal in 1536. So really, for the first third of the 16th century, Portuguese Jews, I won't say that they were free, but they could keep some things, they could learn some things, of course, in Hyde, but nobody was searching for it and nobody was looking for it. On the other end, this is also a problem because for us historians, the files of the Inquisition are the best source for the life of the Anusim. So when there is no Inquisition, there aren't any sources. We don't know how those guys lived back there. And for that reason, I think that Molcho's story is an important one because it gives us an insight into the life of the Anusim in Portugal in the period before the establishment of the Inquisition.
Right, and then two more things is that, first of all, you said he spoke Hebrew, probably one of the proofs, and you can discuss this, that you have in your book, is that he meets David Reuveni and he converses with him. Now, how does he talk with him?
Exactly.
Which is one thing you can talk about. And the other thing is, like you say, he couldn't have gotten all this knowledge. We don't know for sure, but you're assuming that he had this Jewish education. I think something else you discuss in the book is how he leaves, and then we'll get to where he went. Okay, we can leave this, but there was Mikubal, and people came to learn from him, which is even odder than writing a book. So if he was just learned it, but maybe talk a little bit about how you assume that. He must have spoken Hebrew. Otherwise, how else did he talk?
Exactly. Because Reuveni, again, whoever he was, he arrived to Portugal as an ambassador from a Jewish state, which is in the Arabian Peninsula. So basically, he can speak only two languages, Hebrew as a Jew, and Arabic as someone who lives in an Arabic area, and someone whose kingdom is in the Arabian Peninsula. And Molcho, on the other end, he speaks Portuguese. I assume that he could read, maybe even speak Latin, because he was an educated person. I mean, maybe he knew another. Maybe he could hang around in Spanish too, because those are close languages. But he definitely didn't know Arabic. So, how could he communicate with Reuveni? The only possibility is that he knew Hebrew and that they were communicating in Hebrew. You wanted to ask another thing, or?
No, now we're getting back to right. Where does Molcho go? So now he.
Okay. So we know two things about Molcho. We know that he stayed for a while in the Ottoman Empire. We know that he published his book in Saloniki in 1529. We know that Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz mentions his name. Rabbi Yosef Karo mentions his name. So this all takes us to the world of the Ottoman Empire. On the other hand, we also know that he was in Italy. He had those connections with the Pope. The Pope was protecting him. We stayed in Venice. We know many things about his sojourn in Italy. The question is, the popular assumption, if I may say, was that, you know, he's a Kabbalist. He's a messianic figure. Who are the people who are interested in Kabbalah and Messianism? Those are the Sephardim, right? The Sephardim, especially the Sephardim, in the generation after Girush Sfarad, they were involved and they were interested in those things. So the natural place for a messianic Kabbalist to go is to the Ottoman Empire. The point is that so this is to a certain extent a logical assumption, because we don't have any source about it. The point is that we do have two sources. One of them is the writings of Yosef HaKohen. Yosef HaKohen was a Jewish physician living lonely somewhere in Italy in the first half. He was in the middle of the 16th century. He was a Sephardi. He was married to a Sephardi woman. But in any case, he wrote a history book called Divrei HaYamim. And in this history book, it's not a book of Jewish history. It's a book of, one can say, world history. In this book, he has a very big and detailed chapter about Molzo. And he seems to know a lot about Molzo. He held a letter that Molzo sent, and he knows very well everything about Molzo. Now, in his book, he explicitly writes that after leaving Portugal, Molzo went to Italy. So we have one source that Molzo went to Italy. The second source is a manuscript from 1532. This is a manuscript of Ilan Sfirot, a picture of the tree of Sfirot, of all the Sfirot. But it's not only a picture; it also has a perush on the margins of this big Ilan Sfirot. And the guy who wrote this perush writes that in 1528. He was an Italian guy. And he writes that in 1528, he met Molzo, and he was pretty old at 1528. And he says that his soul was immediately connected to Molzo, and he was serving him like a student who serves his rabbi. So we have another proof from Italy that in 1528, Molzo was actually in Italy. So when combining these both sources, it seems that and more than that, when examining where was the place in which more Jews were involved in Messianism, where was the core of Jewish Messianism in the early 16th century, this place is Italy. It's definitely Italy. Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel writes his Messianic writings in Italy. Asher Lemline, an Ashkenazi Jew, establishes this Messianic movement around him in Italy, in the area of Venice. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Shraga, a Sephardi Kabbalist, sits in Italy and calculating them. So basically Italy, and not Saloniki, not the Ottoman Empire, Italy is the best place for a Messianic harbinger to go. For someone who wants to calculate the end, that's the best place for him to go. And Italy is also an important center of Kabbalistic studies from this period on. Combining all those facts, it seems pretty much undoubtedly that Molzo went at first to Italy. And then, as he writes in his book, when my friends in Saloniki were asking me to write them something about some sermon, something about some perushim, some nice things, I decided to do this and I wrote them this book. So let's conclude. Molzo moves from Portugal to Italy, to northern Italy, I assume. And he gains reputation in a very short time. His reputation arrives also to Saloniki. So scholars in Saloniki, such as Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz and others, they live in Saloniki, but they heard that there is this guy in Italy who is a very well... That he knows everything about Kabbalah, that he has those wonderful sermons. We call him Molzo doesn't go to Saloniki to learn Kabbalah there. He goes to Saloniki to teach the members of this Beit Midrash about his notions, about his interpretation of Messianism and of Kabbalah.
So First of all, I want to mention, you mentioned Yosef HaKohen's Divrei Hayamim. That was just, there was a new critical edition published by Reuven Bonfil.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one thing. Now, so Mocha goes to Saloniki. And now, obviously, Reis of Cairo, there's a Reis of Taitichak. I mean, what is his relationship with those? And then you already mentioned he publishes his first work, Sefer HaMefoyer, right? He publishes his first work.
Okay, so when we talk about the people who live in Salonika, there are a few. There's only one person that I can say with confidence that he met Molcho. This is Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz. Because Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz writes in a few places, I heard from Shlomo Molcho that and that. And by saying I heard, it means that I physically met him and heard those things from him. Regarding Rabbi Yosef Karo, there is no proof that Molcho ever met Rabbi Yosef Karo. Because Rabbi Yosef Karo, at 1529, he wasn't in Saloniki, he was in Adrianople, or already on his way to Eretz Israel. More than that, when Rabbi Yosef Karo does mention the Magid, his Magid mentioned Shlomo Molcho, he refers to him as Shlomo B'chiri, Shlomo my chosen one. And he writes, Shlomo Molcho, Shlomo B'chiri. And this title, Shlomo B'chiri, Shlomo the chosen one, throughout Rabbi Yosef Karo's Magid Meisharim refers to Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz. So I assume that Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't know him personally. He didn't know Molcho personally. He heard about him from Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz. And therefore, when he writes about Molcho, when his Magid is, the Magid mentions Molcho, he actually uses the name or the nickname of Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz, Shlomo B'chiri, Shlomo my chosen one. Now, the third figure that you mentioned, this is a very important, although little known, I think in halachic circles, the figure. This is Rabbi Yosef Taitatzak. Rabbi Yosef Taitatzak is a Sephardi rabbi who, after the expulsion from Spain, arrived in Salonika, and he is the most important halachic figure in Salonika in the first third of the 16th century. And this is not a little thing to say, because Salonika is a sort of Jerusalem or Bnei Brak or New York of in those terms. I don't know if New York is the right place, Muncie. Because this is probably the greatest Merkaz HaTorah, the greatest yeshivish city in the Jewish world. And you know, people like Rabbi Yosef Karo, Rabbi Elezer Azikri, Rabbi Shlomo Elkabetz, they all go through Saloniki before they move to Tzfat, before they settle in Israel. And Rabbi Yosef Taitatzak is the most important rabbi in Saloniki at this period. Now, great deal of our knowledge about Molcho comes from two letters that he sent. And those letters were sent to Saloniki. One of them, at least, was sent to Rabbi Yosef Taitatzak. So the conclusion was, okay, it's probably, if you write to someone, you write to someone that you already know, probably Molcho was a student of Rabbi Yosef Taitatzak, and that was what you will find if you look in encyclopedias and in places like that, in general books like that. And basically, it coincided with the notion that Molcho left Portugal and then he went to the Ottoman Empire, to Salonika, to learn in yeshiva from Yosef Taitatzak, and in many places this was fun. But what I discovered is that in I think it was Yud Elul, the 10th of Elul, 1529, which is exactly 10 days after Molcho published his book in Salonika, there was a rabbinic order in Saloniki signed by Rabbi Yosef Taitatzak, saying that no one is allowed to publish a book in Saloniki unless they get permission from at least three or four rabbis of the different communities in Saloniki. And it is absolutely clear that this letter, this edict, was written as a reaction to Molcho's book, that those rabbis who signed this paper didn't like the idea that someone is publishing here a book with calculations of the end and with the messianic speculations. And they were trying to stop it. They were trying to avoid such things from happening again. And again, the first rabbi who is signed on this edict, on this tzav, is Rabbi Yosef Zeitz. More than that, when examining the letter that Molcho sent to Itatzak, that Molcho sent to Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak, you don't get the impression that this is a letter that Molcho wrote to someone that already knew him, to a teacher, to a rabbi. Because in this letter, Molcho basically tells him the very basic facts about his biography, that he was born in Portugal, that he met David Ruveni, that he circumcised himself. Now, if Molcho is already a student of Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak, he probably had told him those things a long time before. So my assumption, my conclusion is that Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak didn't know Molcho personally. More than that, Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak was against Molcho's messianic aspirations. And that after he signed this tzav, this verdict that nobody should publish any book in Saloniki unless he gets the permission of the local rabbis, he tried to reach to Molcho and maybe to understand who is this guy, what does he want to achieve, where did he get from. So basically, I don't think that Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak had any previous connection with Molcho until this letter. More than that, Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak is a very interesting figure because on the one hand, he's a very typical Sephardi scholar in the sense that he knows philosophy. He knows Latin. He refers in various places in his writings to philosophers and so forth. So basically, he's a certain type of a Sephardi rationalist scholar that we are familiar with from this period. On the other end, we also hear that Rabbi Yosef Zeitzak had a Magid. He had this angel talking to him. The Magid of Rabbi Yosef Karo mentions it, and it seems weird. I mean, you won't expect a rational, philosophical rabbi to also have a Magid. What I dare say is that I think that he got in touch with Molcho because he was in a sort of a transition from being this rational, halachic person into a more mystical, Kabbalistic scholar. And I think that he wanted to hear Molcho's story because he knew that Molcho had those revelations, that Molcho had this, Molcho never mentions the Magid, but he saw those visions and he wanted to understand more in order maybe to understand himself better. So this is the reason for him conducting Molcho. I just stated this attempt to stop Molcho's book was very successful. The Molcho's book, the first edition of the book, is very rare. More than that, Rabbi Yosef HaKohen, that we mentioned before, who was very well familiar with Molcho, writes in his book, in his Divrei Hayamim, he writes that when Molcho was in Saloniki, he published a book, but I never saw it. In the second edition of Divrei Hayamim, which was not published, which is only in manuscript, he writes, eventually, I managed to get a copy of this book and I saw it and I liked it very much. But again, it was hard to gain copies of Molcho's sermons of what was later known as the Sefer Mefuar. It was almost impossible to get it in Italy in the first third of in the 1530s.
Right, so we can return more back to that later, but there is actually recently, last year, someone published a Kitvei Shlomo Molcho, and this is included in there with a couple of other works of his. So the next thing really that happens is Molcho goes back to Italy, and also he has some visions, prophecies that he relates that actually come true after he says them, the flood in Rome, earthquake in Portugal. So talk a little bit about that and what happened then.
Okay, so Molcho goes back to Italy. And again, in this letter, he's telling that, like, the minute that he arrived in Italy, already he had opponents. Already he had the people who tried to stop him. and both Jews and non-Jews, and maybe more Jews than non-Jews. And again, this is another proof that Molcho was already in Italy before, because if he was never there, how would anyone know anything about him? So he had opponents, but on the other hand, his practice was he was giving sermons in the synagogue. And again, he writes, and other people write, that his sermons were attended not only by Jews, but also by non-Jews, not only by men, but also by women and children. So basically, he was certainly a very charismatic speaker. I don't know if he was giving those sermons in Hebrew or in Italian. Again, he came from Portugal, but you know, those Latin languages are pretty close to each other. So after a while in Italy, I assume he was fluent also in Italian. And he was preaching in the synagogue and delivering his message. And after a while, he decided to move to Rome. And he goes to Rome. And when he arrives in Rome, his opponents also arrive, and they are trying to block him. And at that point, he had to hide himself. And again, he's not hiding from Christian opponents. He's hiding from his Jewish opponents. And, you know, Messianism is a problematic subject. The established leadership is always afraid from people who are coming with messianic promises and things like that. So it makes sense that he had those opponents. And by hiding from those opponents, basically what he needed to get is some sort of a permission to give sermons, some sort of a document that will allow him to go in public in Rome. And he eventually gets this permission from no other than the Pope. But again, Molcho met the Pope. Molcho was in good relations with the Pope. The Pope saved him his life at least once. But Molcho's relations with the Pope, I mean, Molcho attended the Pope for help. He didn't attend the Pope as part of his messianic purpose, as part of his messianic shlichut. He attends the Pope for help, and I think that if you mention the prophecies that he had before, and the fact that he was prophesying the flood in Rome in 1530, and that he was also prophesying an earthquake in Portugal, and both things happened eventually, I think that this is also the reason why the Pope was so interested in him, because a prophet was a very is a much needed occupation in the 16th century. And we know that the Italian princes held in their courts astrologers and the other people who claim that they can predict the future and that they can help them in I don't know what. And I think that this was best for the relations of Molcho with the Pope. The Pope figured that Molcho can help him. The Pope figured that it's good to hold someone like that, that you can take his advice, that you can trust him in your court. I think that eventually those also became a warm personal relationship, but again, this is something else. The Pope was supporting him, and I think that the Pope considered him as a sort of the court's prophet. Although we don't have any knowledge or reference to prophets that were made by Molcho to the Pope, what we do have is a permission from the Pope to Molcho to speak, to deliver speeches, to deliver sermons, to preach in the synagogue, and to publish books. And this is really unbelievable. I mean, I think that there is nothing parallel to this. The Pope giving a Jew who, again, in Christian eyes, he's a Christian who converted to Judaism. The Pope who gives him a sort of protection card, a sort of a license to speak, a license to publish book. This is I don't think that we have anything like this at all from any other Pope or from any other Jew.
So at this time, Ruveni Frizzlent is back in the picture, I think, right?
Yeah.
And you know, like you said, there are opponents to him. So I think you mentioned the messianism, but what exactly is his messianic preaching? What is he attempting to do at this time with the Pope up until Andrew Vanni, until his meeting with the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, and we'll get to that. But what is going on here? What does he want that there are so many opponents and proponents? What's going on?
Okay. So while in Rome, Molcho had a vision. And actually, the reason why he went to Rome was in order to see this vision. And in this vision, he also got the heavenly information about the flood coming to Rome and an earthquake in Portugal. But in this vision, he's been told that Navila goyim netaticha. You are the prophet of the nations. So basically, and again, Molcho sees himself as Mashiach ben Yosef, not as Mashiach ben David. He doesn't think that he is the final Mashiach. But he thinks, he sees himself as Mashiach ben Yosef, whose job is to prepare the way, to pave the way to the arrival of Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben Yosef has to work in two channels. One of them is the Jewish channel. In the Jewish channel, he has a very simple job, and this is Chazara b'tshuva, to convince his listeners, those who attend the synagogue, that they should repeat, that they should make tshuva, in order that eventually when Mashiach ben David will arrive, the Jews will be prepared to the arrival of the Mashiach. And I think that this was the less, or at least he saw this as the less important, as his less important mission. His most important mission was, again, this being Navi Laguim, to influence the nations. Now, when Molcho writes about the nations, it is absolutely unfavorable in that sense that he predicts their destruction. He writes about the churban, the destruction of Rome. That this is what he's hoping for, and he writes this in the book that he published in Saloniki. Although he doesn't use the word Rome, he uses the word Botsra, which is like, you know, everybody knows when you read Botsra, everybody knows that you refer to Rome, but you didn't write. You don't want to walk over too many toes, right? So write Botsra. Everyone knows that you refer to Rome, but you didn't write the destruction of Rome. So the Pope and others can live with this. And in that sense, his most important purpose was to go and meet Emperor Charles V. Because Emperor Charles V, he is the Holy Roman Emperor. The Holy Roman Emperor is a job that in the century before the 16th century, it was not more than a title given to some German prince, and it didn't have any real content. I mean, in the sense that those German princes were crowned as emperors of the Holy Roman Empire, they had their little German kingdom and nothing more than that. This all changed when it came to Charles V, because Charles V was the grandson of Ferdinand and Isabella. So basically, from his father, he gained Germany, the German land. From his grandparents, he didn't have any uncles. His uncle died, and so from his grandparents, he inherited Spain. From his parents, he also inherited the New World. So he's the king of Germany, the king of Spain, the king of America, so to say. From his aunt, he got the Netherlands and Belgium. And his sister was married to the king of Portugal. So basically, we have here this king. In 16th century Europe, Europeans have this king whose name is Charles. He's a great king. He has a kingdom that goes throughout all of Europe. He controls almost all of Europe and the New World. And again, his name is Charles or Karl, which reminds us of Charlemagne. So people refer to Charles V as the second Charlemagne, as the second Karl the Great, as some sort of a new Christian leader that we didn't have for like hundreds of years. Now, at this period, the European Christians have a great opponent, which is the Ottoman Sultan. The Ottomans gained a lot of power at those years, and until the coronation of Charles V as the Holy Roman Emperor, there were great fears in Europe from Ottoman invasion. There were all those prophecies saying that the Turks are coming, and the Turks are going to conquer Rome, and the Sultan is going to feed his horse from the altar in St. Paul in Rome. So it is a very tight moment in the political relations, in the international relations between East and West, between Islam and Christianity. And Molcho saw this as his opportunity, because Molcho understands that this unavoidable war between East and West, between Christianism and Islam, is this war is basically going to be the war of Gog and Magog. This is going to be the final war. And when he goes to meet Charles V in Regensburg, in a meeting that Charles V holds with all the German princes, the subject on the table in this meeting is fighting the Ottomans. And Molcho wants to make sure that the right decision will be accepted. And the right decision from Molcho's point of view is to go to war with the Ottomans, because he sees this war as I said before, the Milchemet Gog Magog, the war of Gog Magog, the war that after which the Messiah will reveal himself. And I think that this is the epitome of Molcho's purpose, of Molcho's idea of what he has to do as Mashiach ben Yosef. He has to make sure that this war is going to burst. It's going to happen. And this is why he goes to Ratisbon to meet the emperor. And this is why the emperor is much more important to him than the Pope, because the emperor is the strongest Christian figure in Europe in the early 1530s.
So was Molcho and Ruvaini, did they want their own army? Ruvaini wanted his own army to take back Israel, or no? They were just trying to, like you were saying, convince the Holy Roman Emperor to go to war.
Okay, so again, this is a question that in previous scholars were trying to answer it based on some sort of logical assumptions or wishful thinking or something like that. But the point is that we have a letter which was published some 20 or 30 years ago, a letter written by the papal agent in the court of Charles V. You know, when the emperor is making such a great meeting with all the German princes, you can be sure that the Pope will send someone to this meeting to hear what's going on, to see what's going on. And this is what actually happened. The Pope had one of his men in the court of Charles V. His name was Hieronymus Eliander. He was an archbishop, and he was there, and he was informing the Pope on almost daily basis about what's going on in the court. And in two of his letters, he describes the meeting between Molcho and the Reuveni and the Pope. So we have here a description of this meeting from a man who was standing behind the door when the meeting happened, from a man who was talking to Molcho after the meeting, from a man who was talking to the Pope after to the emperor after the meeting. And in those letters, what Hieronymus Eliander writes is not that, as many speculations suggested, that Reuveni was planning to build an army of the Anusim or something like that. No. What Molcho told the Pope is, if you want to win over the Turks, if you want to win over the Ottomans, let me be the first soldier in the field. Let me lead the army. Because I have this sword and shield and flag, and they are all blessed by holy names of God. And I promise you that if you will let me lead the war, I will get you the head of the Sultan. Now, this doesn't make really sense, because you would expect from an Anus, a Jewish son of Jewish Anusim who came back to Judaism, from someone who suffered so much from the Christians, you would expect that he will support the Ottomans and not the Christians. And therefore, and here is my speculation on this point. I think that Molcho was supporting neither of them. Molcho wanted to make sure that this war will happen. What will happen in this war, this is already not Molcho's business. He would leave this to God, right? Molcho, in his writings, he writes that Mashiach ben Yosef will die in a war, will die from a bullet, from a bomb, something like that. He expects this to happen to him, but he wants to make sure that this war will begin. And for that reason, although in his messianic speculations, he calculated that the end would come in the year 1540, the year of Shin, in 1532, he is already going to the emperor and trying to convince him to go on this war, because this is the right hour.
This whole thing makes a lot more sense than saying that they wanted their own Jewish army. They wanted a Christian army to retake a Jewish homeland.
I think that this was only an excuse. Go to war. Let me lead this war. Yeah, I promise you, I can do this, because you know the emperor also heard about all the magical things that happened to Molcho. He survived an execution and so forth. So again, we have in the Jewish Museum in Prague, we have the flag of Molcho or of Reuven. It doesn't really matter, but. We have this flag, and we have here a first-hand evidence from the court of Charles V of what they were discussing, and there is no reference there to a Jewish army or anything like that. Molcho was a bit unlucky in this sense, and it appears that the emperor was pretty rational in this sense, but. I have to say that after the first encounter with Molcho, the emperor tells him, okay, let me think of it. We'll meet again. There will be another meeting. This guy, Hieronymus Eliander, the agent of the Pope, is writing him, I told the Pope, don't listen to him. I told the emperor, don't listen to him. Don't let him fool you. How do you think that people will... What do you think that people will think of you if they will hear that you let a Jew lead your army? And eventually, unfortunately for Molcho, of course, the Pope did the rational thing and put Molcho in cuffs and in jail. They arrested him and Reuveni, and a few months later he executed Molcho. Al Kiddush Hashem.
Right, so I was going to mention that. I mean, the sad result here was the auto de fe and the burning right at the stake, HaKiddush Hashem, and this is mentioned also in the Magid Meisharim from Yosef Karo.
He promises Yosef Karo that he will also be able to become a martyr to Lamut al Kiddush Hashem. And there is an interesting point. A very interesting Jew from this period is Rabbi Yosef Yoselman. He is the Shtadlan. He is the, I don't know what's the English word for that, of the German Jews.
Yossel of Rosheim, right?
Yossel of Rosheim, yeah. So he is this guy who talks to the emperor, who talks to the king. The king listens to him in favor of the Jews, and he helps the Jews, and he's a very important Jew in this period. And he writes in his diary that when I was on my way to this meeting in Regensburg, because he had to represent some Jewish interests there, he writes, I heard that Shlomo Molcho was on his way there. And I heard that he was trying to convince the emperor to do something. And I turned around and came back home and went home. And I sent a letter to Shlomo Molcho warning him that it won't work, warning him not to go to the emperor. And I think that here you can see the rational Jew. Here you can see the Jew, the Jewish leader, that he has his own considers about these things. What might be the outcomes of such a meeting? What might be the outcomes of such a suggestion for the German Jews? And from his point of view, the best thing to do is not to be as a Jew, as the representative of the Jews, of the German Jews. The best thing to do is not to be in the imperial court when Shlomo Molcho arrives there, and indeed he goes back, and then they never meet. There is only this letter of warning that he sends him.
Right, and I mentioned the Beis of Kairos in Magen Meisharim in the beginning of Parshas Vayetzei Habracha. Yeah. Where he says that Yehovah Zayich, right? Kachloimu bechiri zochad iskiri molcho. Yeah, so it is in there for people who want to.
You have there Shlomo bechiri and also the molcho. Yeah, right. As I mentioned before. Yeah.
Hanikra molcho, right? So, I mean that obviously, unfortunately, it's like you're saying there was. So, I mean, what was the? I guess what was the? For first of all, let me ask you one thing. There is this kind of. I've heard that he was offered by the emperor to turn back and to be a Christian. It was that happened, and he turned it down. He died al Kiddush Hashem, and he said, no, he wants to die.
Yeah. We have a source that mentions this. It is not the best source. It's Gedalia ibn Ichya, Shel Shelet HaKabbalah. And he tells many stories which are not always correct, but I don't doubt this thing. Because we also have other references who mention this. Another interesting point is that he tells that when Molcho was taken to the stake and was offered to be alive and to become Christian, to convert to Christianity and stay alive, he's writing that he had something in his mouth, so that he won't be able to spell some sort of a charm or something like that, or holy names, and escape from the stake. So they somehow tied his mouth, and they released it only after they offered him to hear what he has to say. And then he said, "No, I will die." And he was executed. We don't know the exact date of his yahrzeit. We do know that it was in late November, early December, 1529. So. But we don't have the exact date.
Right, and either way, he definitely died al Kiddush Hashem. So, I mean, how was he viewed afterwards? After this happened, you know, what was the view amongst the Jews, especially, what was his view?
That's an interesting question, because as I said before, he wasn't viewed very favorably previous to that. His book was the Rabbanim of Salonika were against his book. He had many opponents, many of them high-ranking Jews. He also had supporters, but he had many opponents. I think that being a martyr is like the entry card to the martyrs club, which is the most highest regarded club in Israel. And it is very interesting that not many years after his death, his tzitzit becomes an halachic proof regarding there is a question whether the threads of the tzitzit must be white or can they be of any other color, I mean, except for Tchelet. And Rabbi Yom Tov Lichtman Heller from the Baal Tosfot Yom Tov from Prague writes in reference to this, and he writes, "I saw his tzitzit in the Pinchas Shul, and it's yellow. So basically, it's made of silk, and it's yellow or green. I don't remember. So basically, you have this person who was persecuted by and seen as a very problematic figure, as someone who might endanger the Jews. And after he died as a martyr, his clothes become a sort of a proof, and people, use maybe colorful tzitzit or tie their tzitzit. He was tying his tzitzit in the Sephardi way, of Yud Kei Vav Kei. So again, his tzitzit is now cited as an halachic evidence, how should you tie your tzitzit. So this is a very interesting transformation. And indeed, in various places where he's mentioned, he's always mentioned as a kadosh, right? So basically, achrei mot kadoshim emor, right? When he's dead, when he died as a martyr, he is a kadosh. All the problems, can put him aside, and we can treat him as a mekadesh Hashem.
Right, and obviously, like I said, obviously the Magid with the Beis Yosef accepting him and the Beis Yosef Karo, and then also halacha, it's brought down in the Paiskim.
Yeah, it's brought down.
So I mean, the question I think that arises then, to me at least, is why is he such a forgotten figure? You ask people today, everybody knows of, everybody knows of other messiahs, but him, he's just, and he was, obviously remembered in a good way, just completely forgotten today.
It's forgotten. I think that's for a couple of reasons. First, I think that after Shabtai Tzvi, whoever was dealing with Messianism became a problem. I mean, after Shabbat, it's not Messianism is a problem. Messianism is a big problem. And okay, you can say, okay, Molcho, he was okay. Eventually, he was the martyr, but no, he failed in his Messianic purpose, in his Messianic shlichut. So the best thing is not to talk too much about him. Leave him alone. I mean, when we have an halachic question and we can answer it using his tzitzit, it's okay. But we don't have any reason to put him especially on the table. Now, his book was printed and reprinted. It was printed in Krakow in 1570 and in Amsterdam and in other places. But it's a small booklet. It deals mainly with some very eccentric messianic Kabbalistic ideas. It's not the mainstream, so you can be a scholar of Kabbalah even without reading Molchus. The notion was that the best thing for everyone is not really to refer to him. He's another failed messiah. Interestingly, in Prague, they held not only his tzitzit, but they also have, nowadays, they have a flag and they have his coat. They have them in Prague, the tzitzit is lost. I mean, it might still be there, but nobody knows that that's his city. But he's, in a way, he's the first Jew to have relics. Again, relics were very uncommon among Jews. Nowadays, it became more popular, especially thinking in more Hasidic circles. I remember Rabbi Nachman's chair in the Breslov Yeshiva in Mishor. But I understand that the chair disappeared since then. But with Islam, I assume that he is the first Jew to have his relics, his coat, his flag kept in a synagogue, and they are still kept there today. And you can view them. You can see them also on the cover of my book. But I got the pictures from the museum. The interesting thing is that Molcho came back to life at early 20th century in very in very interesting circles. Novels were written about him. Plays were played in Yiddish theaters in America in the early 20th century. And the interesting thing is that those novels and plays were written by Zionists, they were written by socialists, by communists, by right-wing Zionists. I mean, in a way, I think that what happened is that Molcho represented a sort of Jewish activism. sort of a Jewish, not waiting to the Messiah, but doing something in order to enhance the arrival of the Messiah. And this attitude was very popular in the early 20th century in this group. So if you are a socialist Jew, you can see him as the savior of the poor. If you are a Zionist, you can see him as the first Zionist and so forth. But again, this was a very short renaissance of like 20, 30 years until, unfortunately, he was again forgotten. And I'm happy to be the one who brings him back to life in a way.
Now, one more thing we have to tie up here, loose end, is that what happens to David Reuveni after this?
Okay. Again, this is another mystery. But from what we know today, I mean, from what we assume, David Reuveni was taken by Charles V with him to Spain for some reason. I mean, he definitely didn't execute him in Mantova with Bolfo. He took him with him. He took him to Spain. And to the best of our knowledge, he was executed in 1538 in an auto de fe in a place called Vieria in 1538, to the best of my memory right now. And an interesting thing is that this story set the end for the interest in the lost tribes in the 16th century. I mean, in the heyday of interest in the lost tribes began in something like 1530, and it ended up with the arrest of David Reuveni. Because if the ambassador from the lost tribes was arrested by the Christian emperor, and nobody came to his help, and he was taken away somewhere, so probably chances are we probably can't hope for help from the lost tribes. Interest in the lost tribes raised again in the 17th century, but it declined after the arrest of the David Reuveni.
That's unfortunately sad ending. Both died. HaKadosh Hashem, very, very unfortunate. So with Malcho, obviously, there's like I mentioned this earlier, there's last year someone printed, you know, the writings, Kisvei Reb Shlomo Malcho HaKadosh. They called him Reb Shlomo Malcho HaKadosh, it says. And he also published some Lechu Neran Al-Eis HaGula. He sort of compiled, edited a pirish on Lechadidi from him. Reuveni, we mentioned there is a diary. I don't know if it's available anymore. I don't think so. But there was an edited version of the diary. And then...
Actually, you know, it's available online. You can find it online. It was translated to English in other Jewish travelers. Not the best translation, to say the least, but if anyone is interested, you can easily gain access to those writings. But yeah, Reuveni was forgotten even more than Shlomo Malcho. That's definitely.
Right, and then there's your book, which I'll include a link to. I mean, I don't know if people listening to this in the U.S. it's harder to get here, but in Israel it's available online, and it is. I'm sure there are ways to get it here, and it is in Hebrew. I would ask you: are there any plans to make it to an English translation? Or
there are plans. There are plans, and I inform you when it will happen. Be'ezrat Hashem.
Right, and something else interesting on the cover, we even forgot to mention, Shlomo Malcho, maybe people know of his famous signature, that his signature includes the flag in his signature.
In his lamed, yeah, in the letter lamed, the flag. And again, this is the flag that we have in Prague, and this is the flag mentioned in his meeting with the Emperor Karl V.
So right now in English, on Reuveni and Malcho, there's really not a lot of options. People want reading material.
Not a lot of options. No. I think that I should look into the Wikipedia entry and see if it is updated. But other than that, I mean, there are references in specific, I guess, in Moshe Idel's big book, Messianic Kabbalist. There is a chapter about him, a very good chapter about him. And so forth. There are chapters, there are articles in academic journals about him, but not anything which is more than that.
Did you mention that? Did you write an article in English on Reuveni that's available?
On David Reuveni, yeah.
And is that Is that on your academia page? Where can people find that?
Yeah, you can find it in academia. It's called History, Politics, Messianism, David Reuveni something. So if you write my name or write this, you'll be able to find it.
I'll try to include that in the show's notes. And just finally, as we finish up, are you working on any new projects, any new books, or no?
Basically, I'm working on recently on the relations between Sfaradim and Ashkenazim in Italy. Because basically, you know, Ashkenazim lived their life. Sfaradim lived their life. There was almost no interaction between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. To a great extent, the first place where Ashkenazim and Sfaradim meet, not as Ashkenazi travel to Sfarad or Sfaradi travel to Ashkenaz, it is an Ashkenazi community with a Sephardi community is northern Italy in the 16th century, and some interesting things happens there. Let me mention only one, and that is that Molcho followers were mostly Ashkenazim. So basically, Messianism in the 16th century, in the exact years after the expulsion from Spain, was a much more Ashkenazi practice than Sephardi practice. Molcho's greatest opponent was a Sephardi. All his followers that we know about him were Ashkenazi. So that's just, you know, a point to think that things are not always as they seem today. If things seem in a certain way today, it doesn't mean that they also were that way 400 or 500 years ago.
Fascinating. So hopefully this will enlighten people a little bit, know a little bit more about Molcho and Reuveni. And thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for suggesting me to join you. Thank you very much.
Thank you again.